I'm Inez Stettman.
I'm Ben Weingarten.
I'm Amber Duke.
And I'm Will Chamberlain.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common good and common sense meet. NatCon Squad is produced by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, like usual, we have a great lineup of topics, most of them depressing, to share with you this week. This has not been an uplifting podcast for quite some time. So our topics today, first, we're going to go to Will. We're going to talk about Trump's announcement about his abortion policy for the upcoming election. Then I'm going to talk about a new attempt from the Biden administration to institute illegal student loan forgiveness. And then we're going to move over to Amber. So we're going to talk about some of the inter-GOP fights over Ukraine funding in Congress. And finally, we're going to wrap it up with the Biden DOJ coming for IRS whistleblowers. And Ben is going to talk us through that topic. So with that, I'll kick it over to Will.
Thanks, Inez. So obviously, the major news this morning was that President Trump announced on Truth Social what his policy in the general election for abortion would be. And honestly, I mean, a lot of people are criticizing it because it is not firmly pro-life in the sense that he is saying that he's leaving it to the states, that he's not going to advocate for a federal ban or any particular number of weeks, and that he supports the exceptions of rape, incest, and the life of the mother. I think that what the way people really should understand this is that Trump is effectively a messenger because of where the issue currently is politically. Donald Trump, you know, even in his most like normal circumstances, is not like the most, he's motivated by policy. That's not his primary motivation to be leader. And now in particular, given that he's facing indictments in multiple jurisdictions, he is particularly focused on what will help him win and what will lead to him being in the White House again, because the alternative is going to jail. So I don't think that, you know, people are angry at Trump. I've seen plenty of anger at Trump about this, especially from pro-lifers. And my rejoinder to them would be, if this were a more politically popular issue, if you had better politics on this issue, Donald Trump would be with you, but he's not. And I think the reason for that is, abortion and referendums have been losing all over the country. They've been, and not in places that are blue. They lost in Kansas. They lost in Ohio, deep, deep red states. And so I think if anything, this should be kind of, I mean, if those referenda weren't wake up calls for the pro-life movement, this should be one where they simply don't have purchase with a large chunk of the country on their primary agenda item. And so the best they can hope for from a presidential candidate is to be effectively neutral on the issue, to say it's up to the states, I'm not going to support a federal ban. Back when I was supporting Governor DeSantis after I had left the governor's office, I tweeted something that a lot of people misunderstood. I tweeted out that if President Trump wins, the GOP is not going to be a pro-life party anymore. And a lot of people misunderstood that. They thought I was really harshly criticizing Trump, but more I was more making a neutral statement, which is that when you have two candidates, one of them who's firmly pro-life and the other who's disrespecting that position formally by saying things like the heartbeat bill to stand aside was a terrible thing. As a practical matter, if you can't beat that candidate, you're ultimately, you know, you're ceding a lot of ground and you look a lot weaker. And I think that what the pro-life needs movement, rather than get angry at Donald Trump personally, because I don't think that's productive, they just need to take this as sort of a gut check moment. Where, okay, we are, you know, a guy who's solely motivated by winning elections thinks that we're a drag on his chances. There's a lot of work to be done to persuade the broader public that we're in the right on this.
Yeah, I have a few thoughts on this. One, it shows who Donald Trump is appealing to now. I mean, he's pretty much locked up the Republican Party. If we think back to 2016, he had a lot of reasons to make overtures to the conservative wing of the Republican Party, a lot of whom voted for Cruz and were uncertain about Trump, right? So think back to the list of judges, for example, that he released. Now, I don't think he feels that he has to do that. I mean, consistently, he gets 90-95% approval from Republicans, even when he does touch third rails, as Will pointed out. So I don't think that he's too worried about essentially about conservative Republicans coming out to vote for him. So I think that's part of the calculation. Now, that might be something to consider if he gets a second term, that conservatives will have less purchase in that administration potentially, because he doesn't really have a reason to make overtures to conservatives anymore, because we're pretty firmly in the Trump column, frankly. So I guess we're a little bit in the position of Black voters in the Democratic Party, in the sense that we're not going anywhere else. So, you know, he doesn't feel like he has to make concessions to us. I do wonder how much this is going to help. I agree with Will's assessment politically of what the abortion issue is doing to the GOP. That being said, the left is willing to lie so blatantly about Republican positions on all of these things that I don't know that cutting a nuanced position where he's in favor of states, you know, dealing with this issue however they see fit, but against a national ban, I don't know that that's actually going to help that much. They're still going to paint him as the anti-abortion candidate, whether he likes it or not. That being said, I mean, I think accidentally Trump has hit on the constitutional position here. I've long held that position that, in fact, there is no constitutional power. I mean, they realize this is a totally quaint discussion in an era of Rubicons, but there is no federal power to legislate about murder unless there's a direct federal hook. This is a police power. And the contrary example I've always used is there are big differences in self-defense laws that amount to protection of life, or withdrawing the protection of life to certain, for example, home invaders. So in Texas, the exact same situation, you have somebody breaking into a home, homeowner shoots that person dead. That is a legally justified killing in Texas. That's murder in California, right? So you could say that California is not protecting the life of that break-in. Now, I'm not making the moral comparison between the unborn baby and a criminal, but in terms of defining murder, you have states with different definitions of murder, right? And the question is, does Congress have the power to come in and say, well, if the majority of Congress says that California is right about self-defense, is that a legitimate federal power? I would say no. So I think he's accidentally hit on the constitutionally appropriate response here. That being said, you know, this reveals a few things. One, as Will said, the real weakness of the pro-life position in terms of actually convincing Americans. And what we've seen, unfortunately, is polls sliding over time. In other words, before Dobbs, you see that the American position is quite moderate, where the majority of Americans are in favor of abortion through the first trimester, but have serious doubts about it in the second and definitely in the third trimester. Now you see that line moving. So even very extreme abortion amendments that, you know, legalize abortion right up until the moment of birth, those also garner large support. So when given a choice, you know, people are actually sliding into a more pro-life position. I'm sorry, pro-choice position. So all of this is like, you know, I guess a challenge to the pro-life movement. You have to persuade your fellow Americans. That's as simple as that.
Yeah, speaking as I assume I'm probably the most pro-life person on this podcast, but maybe I'm wrong, but I find it hard to be angry about this because one, it's not surprising. Trump has actually been pretty consistent on where he stands on abortion since he started running for office in 2015. He said then that he wanted to overturn Roe v. Wade and then kick it back to the states. He's never come out in favor of any sort of federal limit on abortion. So I don't know why the pro-life movement thought that he was going to do that now. And from a simply pragmatic standpoint, I tend to agree with Will that this was the right claim to stake. But I'm also find myself hearing what Inez said about the idea that the left is going to paint Trump as an extremist regardless. And I think that's true as well, because the Biden administration, immediately after Trump put out his statement, announced that they were holding a press call to talk about how Trump supports extreme abortion bans in the states. So what they're going to do to spin this is say, well, if Trump wants to allow the states to decide, then he's tacitly supporting any position that a state does on abortion, including a 6-week ban, or including in the other extreme example, abortion up until the moment of birth. So they're not going to let him have the moderate ground on this issue no matter what. But I think, you know, from again, from a political and sort of cultural standpoint, it makes sense, I think, to have the states sort of wage this war over the next 4 or 5 years. It forces the pro-life movement to hone their messaging, to figure out how they can convince Americans to get on their side on this issue. You really do have to think about the fact that the culture did shift more towards the pro-choice position in the aftermath of Dobbs. And it's going to take a lot of work to get people back in terms of public opinion to where they were before Roe was overturned. And if pro-lifers can hold their nose and vote for Trump despite this, which I don't know what their alternative would be. I guess staying home. Obviously, they couldn't vote for Biden or RFK or whoever. If Trump were to win in November, that gives them basically the next 4 years to just focus all of their resources on fighting these battles at the state level, which I think would be beneficial for them, even if they don't get the national ban that they're hoping for.
Yeah, to me, this is the politically rational move. You know, we can talk about constitutionality, we can talk about morality more broadly. The question you have to ask is, what position will lose versus potentially gain Donald Trump the most votes? And he's obviously going to be portrayed the way the left wants to portray him, no matter what, on the one hand. On the other hand, does this position alienate people who would otherwise firmly be in the pro-Trump camp? It's hard to imagine still any of them sitting on their hands and staying home, or obviously voting for the alternative, which is the obvious infanticide alternative on the other side, as President Trump emphasized in his remarks when he sort of elaborated on his position here. So this is the prudential move, given where the culture is, where the politics is, and where public sentiment is more broadly. And yeah, the decision rests with the states or the people, and that's where the war ought to be waged. So to an extent, this takes the issue off the table, but obviously you're going to have the anti-Trump forces who are going to say that, yes, he's de facto where the most quote-unquote extreme conservative is, again, versus the opposite, the other side of the coin, which is the infanticide position. So this takes the issue off the table far ahead of the election. And yes, Democrats will cast the Republican or conservative position however they want to cast it. But to me, given the kind of untenable scenario that you face, given where the opposition is and where public sentiment is on the issue, this is obviously, I think, the rational move, and probably the move that you'll see other Republican leaders on a national level embracing as we move towards the election as well.
So I will take the moderator's prerogative to turn topics over to myself. I have been predicting that there would be a large student loan forgiveness attempt leading up to the election from the Biden administration. And sure enough, he is announcing one. We're recording this on Monday, and he's announcing today a quite large scale loan forgiveness package that will go out to 23 million borrowers, and 10 million of those borrowers will get substantial loan relief from more than $5,000. So there's a number of bases on which people can qualify. But the bottom line is that once again, the Biden administration is launching what is likely to be an illegal. The basis is different for this forgiveness. He's basing it on a different statute than the previous one that was struck down by the Supreme Court. But what is ultimately likely to be struck down by the courts once again, and I just want to remind people, this is the exact playbook that was run on us in 2022 in the midterms, where Biden launched what the administration knew was likely to be a program that would be invalidated by the Supreme Court. Nevertheless, because it is at this point unlikely that all of those legal challenges will be adjudicated once there's a month-long comment period for this program. So once that happens and the legal challenges will start, it's very unlikely that those challenges will be adjudicated before the election. So what we have is this plan where Biden is going to get credit, especially with young voters, for a plan that he himself knows is unlikely to survive legal challenge, but is nevertheless going to deliver the kind of political benefits for the election that Democrats want. And as I remind you guys every time, this made a difference in the 2022 midterms. There was a last minute spike in young voters coming out to the polls who are generally very unenthusiastic about Joe Biden. Now, that's not to say that they're voting for Trump. They're generally left wing, but they are unenthusiastic about Biden. And it makes a huge difference to Democrats whether young voters stay home or turn out enthusiastically. And one of the things that's proven to get them to actually turn out enthusiastically is student loan forgiveness. So this is a very, very smart political play for Democrats. It's worked before. It's likely to work again. You know, how much, I don't know, but it's likely to work again. And not to beat a dead horse, but it's because the right has not come up with a solution. Student loan debt, whether, you know, sort of certain conservatives want to hear it or not, is a political problem. There are virtually no private lenders in the market. There is no like sort of free market solution. This is a government constructed program. This is a government constructed sector where universities have been benefiting from the federal government and from taxpayer money for decades and decades and decades. And it has pushed up the college costs. Another headline today is that the average college tuition is skyrocketing. And now a lot of parents are looking at $95,000 a year per year for private universities. That's a new high, right? So a lot of these forgiveness plans actually push up that number even higher. College costs goes up because it's so heavily subsidized by the federal government. So you can imagine there's a little escalator. If those of you watching on YouTube can see, I'm putting my hands on top of each other. So there's a baseline tuition. The federal government makes loans available up to the tuition line, the average tuition, right, in the country. Then colleges say, well, everybody has access to X amount of loans, plus, you know, people can put together an extra $5,000, right? So they raise that tuition from, you know, the baseline to plus 5,000. Well, then the next day the government comes back and says, well, okay, now the average tuition is plus $5,000. So they raise the loans to that. And colleges do the same thing. And this is what's caused college tuition rates to skyrocket well above inflation. We're talking 2 to 3 times the cost that it was even in the 1990s or early 2000s in real dollars, depending on whether you're going to public or private university. So the bottom line is this is not a free market sector. This is not a personal responsibility sector. There are no private lenders, virtually no private lenders in this. The taxpayer is the bank in this case. And it's a political problem for that reason. So Republicans have a choice. They can either continue to suffer politically as Democrats hand out debt jubilees to their constituents over and over and over again, or they can actually look at the problem as it is and not how they imagine it to be in the free market. And they can look at people who are entities, I should say, that have made an enormous amount of money off of this system that's funded by the federal government, and that's universities. So we have a choice. We can make, we can pay for this through these debt jubilees, both in terms of as taxpayers, we can pay for this because those loans are going into default. This is not a sustainable system. The cost is not sustainable. The value of the degree is not sustainable. So either we can pay as taxpayers and pay at the ballot box as Democrats reap the benefits of handing out goodies to their voters, or we can propose an alternative and we can make universities pay for the system that they have benefited from enormously over the last, you know, several decades, in addition to being, you know, our domestic enemies and pumping out ideas that are incredibly dangerous for the country and that we talk about every day on here as something that is necessary to save the country from. So to my mind, it's an easy choice, but I'll throw it out to you guys for your thoughts.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. And I would just add, there's always the fundamental unjust factor of working class Americans paying for the education of people who either become the elites or at the very least have a much higher earning potential because they went to college. The majority of student debt in this country is held by people who have master's degree, PhDs, basically who went beyond just a 4-year bachelor's degree. So it really is the case. I mean, we say it over and over again ad nauseum, and it sounds like a meme at this point, but it really is the case that you have plumbers and electricians paying for the education of doctors and lawyers. And for the party that supposedly is for the working class, particularly Mr. Amtrak Joe or Scranton Joe, to continuously support these positions, these bribes to voters that cut against the exact coalition he claims to be fighting for, you know, the Biden administration puffing up the fact that he was supposedly the first president to walk the UAW picket line. It's just such fundamentally a joke. And the fact that everyone just goes along with it and the media goes along with it is very indicative of where our institutions are in terms of siding with democratic political power and refusing to question anything that comes from the left.
Yeah, I'm definitely for an all of the above option in terms of taking it to the schools. The schools are obviously indoctrination centers that credential the DEI regime. And the biggest correlative, it seems, with the spiraling costs of education beyond obviously government, and that means us subsidizing it, is the administrators, the DEI administrators at the schools. So it's like levels upon levels of perversity in terms of what we're funding, how it's being funded, obviously the abuse of presidential power, knowingly engaging in the cynical, illegal, unconstitutional gambit. And it's one vote buying scheme among several vote buying schemes on top of, as we've talked about before, the Biden bucks, which is used taxpayer dollars to further juice Democrat vote. The only positive thing that I could say potentially coming out of this is that does the fact that he needs to engage in this vote buying scheme indicate fear on the Democrat side that the youth vote isn't actually where it needs to be for them? And there's really interesting polling. Maybe it's just noise. Maybe it's issues with the pollsters suggesting a massive shift in terms of millennial and Gen Z voters towards Trump and away from Biden. Does that jibe with everything we know about these populations? No, it doesn't. So maybe there's some noise in the polling. Maybe there are errors in the polling. But maybe, just maybe, this suggests real alarm on the Democrat side. At minimum, I assume that there's not enthusiasm for Joe. But maybe even more shockingly, that there actually is some kind of shift going on beneath the hood in terms of younger voters requiring desperate and cynical ploys like these.
Yeah, I mean, it's I think basically everybody's on the same page here, and I agree with Inez totally. The foundational problem is Republicans have not done a good job of highlighting that the people who need to be paying for this are the universities, using the language of fraud to describe the student loan problem, that universities have been defrauding students. For too long, the rhetoric has always been one of personal responsibility. Oh, you took out the loan, you need to pay it back. It's like in any other industry, when people were giving out loans of $200,000 to 18-year-olds with a 50% default rate, you would have the FTC on them, and even conservatives wouldn't really have a problem with it. We're not pro-fraud over here. So it's not surprising that Biden has a message on this, but there's such a powerful conservative message available to us. And it's too bad that we're not taking it.
And with that, I believe we are going to Amber to talk about the Ukraine funding fights in Congress.
Right. So I wanted to talk about this because there were some comments made by a Republican congressman, Mike Turner from Ohio, on this issue during an interview with CNN this week. And they were interesting comments. He accused his fellow Republicans who don't want to fund Ukraine in perpetuity of falling for Russian propaganda, and went on to talk about the fight over Ukraine's inclusion in NATO, which Tony Blinken indicated just last week that will happen at some point after the war, which is a more aggressive statement compared to a few years ago when comments by Biden and his administration officials were more in the lines of Ukraine basically has a lot of work to do to become a member of NATO, and it's premature to have that conversation. Now they're saying that it's inevitable that Ukraine will join. So Mike Turner made these comments, and they come as the GOP is still in this fight over whether or not they should fund Ukraine. Obviously, the American populace is opposed to the idea of continuing to send money to Ukraine. The polls have continuously shifted towards people being skeptical, if not outright opposed, to the idea of sending another $10 billion here, $10 billion there. We've already sent almost $100 billion to Ukraine over the past few years for not much benefit. There still seems to be no tangible goal that the United States is working towards by helping Ukraine. There's no indication that Ukraine has any chance of winning the war at this point. And there has been at least one instance in which the US and the UK worked together to tamp down the potential for negotiations between Ukraine and Russia very early on into the war, and still seem quite reflexively opposed to that idea. So Mike Turner, unfortunately, is part of the larger sort of GOP establishment in terms of where they stand on this issue. And you basically have the Freedom Caucus and then a few other people who are holding the line. And luckily that includes for now Speaker Mike Johnson, who has refused to bring up a joint funding bill for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan that's sort of been languishing in the Senate. But Mike Johnson has recently suggested that he wants an alternative to just outright giving weaponry and money to Ukraine. And two of the suggestions included giving Ukraine a loan, which I don't know why anyone thinks that would be paid back. The idea is kind of ludicrous on its face. But then he also suggested using money that was seized from Russian officials through sanctions be used to continue to fund the war effort. And I think that this just kind of fundamentally misses the point. Yes, this is about fiscal responsibility. Yes, it's about the fact that the money being sent to Ukraine could be better used at home. It could be better. There's so many things domestically that $100 billion could be spent on. But that's not the only consideration for why the American people and why the conservative flank of the GOP do not want to continue sending money there. It's also because you're prolonging the inevitable. You're contributing to an increased loss of life. Ukraine is conscripting elderly men at this point. They just lowered their conscription rate as well to get younger men because their population is being killed in this war. You have Russians being killed unnecessarily. And again, no seeming end to any of this. And so if you're just sending money without an end date or an end goal, you're just contributing to a devastating loss of life for no seeming reason. So it's more than just we can give Ukraine a loan and then we can feel better about the fact that we're not actually sending taxpayer dollars to disappear into the ether. But what is the point of doing this, and how is this at this point still in America's interest to continue funding this in perpetuity? So even Speaker Johnson's comments suggested to me that he really doesn't quite fully get it. And then one final point on this is that in this same interview, Congressman Mike Turner defended his vote to reauthorize FISA warrants and said that Americans should rest easy because FISA is simply to stop terrorists and they're not spying on Americans, which is pretty hysterical considering what we learned about the way the process was abused repeatedly to spy on Trump campaign officials and the Trump administration. So, I mean, clearly this guy is completely out of touch with the American people. But I mean, I think even more broadly outside of the GOP, they're fighting about it, but it's bigger than a internal party fight. It's really about the uniparty versus the American people and the few people in Congress who understand where the public is on this issue. Because of course you have a large swath of the Democratic Party as well that has gotten completely on board with just sending billions upon billions of additional dollars to Ukraine and has sided with the Republican establishment on this. So this is just a perfect example of how people in Congress tend to be incredibly out of touch with the wishes of their constituents. And in doing so, end up making these very condescending and ridiculous comments, like the ones Mike Turner made, suggesting that everyone who disagrees with him on this is merely falling victim to Russian propaganda. And with that, I'll let it go to the group.
I obviously have a different view about the Ukrainian conflict than many people on the right. And I think Putin actually was very clear in the interview he gave to Tucker Carlson, which I actually recommend that everybody watch. I was sort of skeptical that it would be a worthwhile interview. I thought it turned out to be a very worthwhile interview. I thought Tucker did a good job actually pushing back against Putin on key things. But it's very clear to me that the sort of aggression behind the war from Russia's side is much more to do with ideology, with reconstituting the Russian Empire and with Russian pride in that endeavor than it does any specifics about NATO. I think, that's the most reasonable part of the case. So I think that's why Americans so often glom onto it. I think the sort of American mercantilist mentality, the rising tide lifts all the boats, this is the part we can understand, right? Like, we understand why you don't want NATO at your border. Like, This is a sort of normal engagement between great powers, and it's very logical, and that helps. But I think it's much deeper. I think that the roots of the conflict are much deeper than that. I think Putin himself that's the reason that he went in for an hour of Russian history before getting to anything about NATO. And I think we would be sort of, well, I guess we would be falling in our own tradition of serially misunderstanding peoples other than ourselves, and Russia being at the top of that list. But so aside from that, I think there's a really huge concern that's being revealed here, regardless of where one falls on any of these wars, right, that are being bundled together in the Senate, potentially Taiwan, right, an invasion of Taiwan, the current conflict in Gaza and Israel, and Ukraine. And this is something that's happening across the West. We do not have enough ammunition. And worse than that, we do not currently have the capability to manufacture the levels of ammunition that are necessary in like a full-scale modern war. And that's something that should terrify us.
The key questions always, and they're only further kind of exacerbated or underpinned by the constraints that we've talked about, are, what is the goal of U.S. engagement in this war? Are the goals achievable ultimately? How do you assess progress, good or bad? And then can you actually even follow the money and the weaponry? And I still have found the administration, essentially administration-wide, lacking in terms of credible, cogent, comprehensive responses to any of those questions. And the national interest demands that you be able to answer those questions in a compelling way when you're risking American life, limb, or fortune in connection with a battle like this.
With that, we'll turn it back to Ben. I thought he was going to just go straight through, but back to Ben to talk about the DOJ and potential whistleblowers and how they've treated them.
So on an entirely different note, there's been sort of a ramping up in terms of oversight activities of several Republican committees and then at least one Republican senator in the way of potential retaliatory efforts against the IRS whistleblowers in the Hunter Biden non-investigation and non-prosecution until it was exposed by those whistleblowers, which is obviously part and parcel of the much broader issue of the impeachment inquiry, which includes not just the Biden family's international influence peddling, but also the systematic obstruction of it by the DOJ and Biden administration agencies. So the troubling kind of allegations or claims that have come to the fore are that we've long known that Hunter Biden's legal team was out there badgering the Justice Department to pursue the IRS whistleblowers, leaking information about them, or trying to spin damaging information about them, claiming that they engaged in unlawful disclosures when they brought forth these allegations about what the DOJ and IRS were doing or not doing in connection with the seriously shady and illegal behavior that Hunter Biden was engaging in, that now the DOJ admits, obviously with a couple prosecutions that they have going. But there's been a full effort to try and smear and dirty the whistleblowers in the media and then also badger the DOJ to pursue them for purported unlawful leaks of protected taxpayer information. And there's very clear statutes that show that if you work for the IRS and you want to bring forth tax records, which would otherwise be confidential, there are channels and appropriate ways to do so, including bringing them to the relevant committees that the IRS whistleblowers did in consultation with lawyers who made sure that essentially the whole process was done clearly consistent with the letter and spirit of the law. But nevertheless, you've had Hunter Biden's team aggressively attacking them. And again, not just in the media or in letters to the DOJ saying you really need to investigate for these unlawful disclosures, but also in court filings as well. And in a case, Biden v. the IRS, that's Hunter Biden v. the IRS, where they're attacking the IRS essentially for allowing the leak of unlawful disclosures, the putting forth of unlawful disclosures, which is targeting, of course, agents Shapley and Ziegler, the two IRS whistleblowers. Recently also, Special Counsel Weiss put forth a filing responding to Hunter Biden's legal team trying to get it to dismiss the case, where in response to Hunter Biden's attacks on the whistleblowers, the DOJ does not defend the whistleblowers in seeking to quash this motion to dismiss from Hunter Biden's side, does not protect the whistleblowers and say basically they made lawful disclosures pursuant to relevant statute. And instead they talk about, well, actually the IRS took measures to ensure that the whistleblowers were properly dealt with in connection with their conduct. And then essentially they surreptitiously, but not surreptitiously, refer to a potential ongoing investigation and then sealed documents associated with that investigation. And the suggestion is very clear that it's a potential investigation into the whistleblowers for their disclosures. And in that IRS case as well, DOJ's tax division is actually defending the government. They also don't refer to the relevant statute that protects the whistleblowers for their these disclosures. So the claim that's being made by members of Congress, as well as Empower Oversight, which represents IRS Special Agent Shapley, Supervisory Special Agent Shapley, is that there's a massive campaign essentially to go after the whistleblowers who were pulled off of the case by the DOJ. DOJ's tax division, which they blew the whistle on, are the ones that are not defending them in that IRS case. Special Counsel Weiss himself, of course, was the subject of the whistleblower allegations. And yet it's that DOJ that's not, of course, vigorously defending the whistleblowers in connection with the prosecution against Hunter Biden. So the whole mess is essentially that there's one long-running retaliatory effort against the whistleblowers. And Special Counsel Weiss is, of course, massively conflicted here, as is the DOJ itself, and essentially on the side of Hunter Biden's team in not protecting them. So, you know, this raises, obviously, the specter of, you know, kind of more weaponization of authorities. But I also think it gets to a broader question of who would ever want to be a whistleblower against this regime? How great is the chill to the extent the government brings its full force against these whistleblowers? It's one thing pulling punches in these cases, but it's another thing, obviously, if it is retaliating at the urging of Hunter Biden's legal team. So I'm curious what you all make of, first of all, the fact that you do have members of Congress who are actually stepping in and trying to do something about this. But more broadly, who is ever going to want to whistleblow? And then more broadly than that, who's ever going to work for an administrative state where the lawlessness and corruption, if you even consider potentially standing up and doing something about it, chances are you're going to get your head lopped off?
Yeah, I think in general, the whistleblower problem, I mean, it's absolutely hypocritical. Like, when there were Democrat whistleblowers like Alexander Vindman, they were lauded endlessly, for fighting for democracy. But anytime you have an FBI whistleblower now against FBI boosters, they're in danger to democracy. This is, the idea that there's just going to be this neutral value where everybody thinks whistleblowers are good. That's not going to happen in modern American politics. The Democrats are far too ruthless. And we should recognize that just remember it next time we're in power, that anytime they try and concern troll us about the value of whistleblowers, that they would jail a conservative whistleblower in a half a second.
Yeah, and specifically if in regards to the IRS whistleblowers, when they first came forward, the Democrats very loudly accused them of not following proper whistleblower protocol. They attacked their resumes and their history working for the IRS. All of their claims turned out not to be true. It turned out these were two very stand-up individuals who had a very respected work history, who went through all of the proper whistleblower channels before going to the members of Congress that they went to. And it just speaks to that double standard that Will's talking about in terms of how the left treats people who come forward with concerns about their government. It all depends on whether or not they're attacking the right person. And it's really shameful.
I mean, my thought on this is that we shouldn't be surprised by this. As a whole, federal employees are very far left. If you look at the FEC tracked donations to political parties, it's 95% to Democrats. Now, in some ways, this makes sense. Even pre-Trump era, right? It makes sense because, of course, the employees of the federal government want to have the party in power that grows the federal government more extensively, although Republicans are pretty good at doing that too. But in recent years, it has become extremely clear that the administrative state is not apolitical. These are people with very strong political opinions who feel completely comfortable and authorized to insert themselves into, ironically, American democracy that everyone is always screeching about. I guess the good news here is I actually don't think this is a difficult problem to solve. It requires undoing some of those Wilsonian era protections and the idea that these 2.8 million civilian bureaucrats who run the government, even when Joe Biden, who is clearly out to lunch half the time, is at the head of the executive branch, are not exercising their political opinions in running the government the way that they see fit, right up into, you know, which of their own are considered heroic whistleblowers and which of their own are considered traitors. This is not small d democratic. It's not the way the American system, constitutional system, is supposed to function. But unfortunately, there's a pretty easy fix, which is we just need to fire a few of these people. And we need to make it legally possible to fire a bunch of these people. Most people, when having to choose, I mean, as we know very well on the right, when having to choose between their jobs and, sort of going along with the regime from the top, most people will choose to go along. I think we really only need to change the laws to fire a few of the worst offenders, a few people who have completely abused their power in positions of government that they were not elected to by the people, but nevertheless feel perfectly at liberty to use in service of their own political ends. We need to fire a bunch of these people, metaphorically, to be clear, metaphorically nail their scalps to the wall, let everybody see it. And I think largely that will improve the way the federal government functions, not only from an efficiency standpoint, which is of course important, because this also protects people who just like don't do any work. Or for example, in one memorable case, Congress had to pass an entire law in 2017 so that employers or supervisors within the federal government could fire their employees for watching pornography on government computers during work hours, because that you could not fire someone for doing that before they actually passed a law to do it. So, there'll be an efficiency improvement from that point, but much more important is to restore some kind of actual control of the American citizen over what 90% of the government is just like doing on its own right now to its own ends. So the solution is there, but it's obviously requires some political courage and to be able to withstand the New York Times screaming about how democracy dies in darkness, even though this is a democratically restorative move. So with that, I'm going to transfer to final thoughts, and to avoid the usual Mexican standoff, I'll give my final thought first. So there have been a series of McKinsey studies upon which basically our entire corporate sector have relied to make the case that DEI and diversity are good for the bottom line. These are studies in 2015, 2018, 2020, and 2023. And those studies have now pretty effectively been shown to be a pile of trash. We've had other academic actors go in, take the exact same data set and be unable to replicate the results that it's helpful for the bottom line, that all these DEI programs on diversity are helpful for the bottom line. And then also there's all kinds of critique of the methodology, and this is not bottom line, this is not replicable. And these studies, I mean, this sounds like an obvious thing, but these studies have been used and cited throughout the entire corporate sector to back up a ton of these decisions that major American corporations have made with regard to their hiring practices, with regard to spending, you know, millions and billions of dollars pouring them into diversity programs, and also, you know, donating to causes like BLM, right? And finally, these studies have been used in the government. So the Biden Navy and Department of Defense have used these exact studies to justify diversifying the military as a primary goal. So these are really important studies, and the fact that they have just been debunked, I think, is worth taking note of. Of course, those of us on the right probably wouldn't have taken them seriously to begin with, but I do think it's another indication that at least in the private sector, some of this stuff is starting to soften up. The ground is softening up for a little bit of a return to bottom line thinking in the private sector. And this may help towards that goal with people who are not overtly ideological.
I'll go ahead and go next, because I wanted to go back for a second to the conversation we were having about the federal bureaucracy, because there was reporting that the Biden Office of Personnel Management has issued an edict or plans to issue an edict that would sort of preemptively try to stymie Trump's moves to revise Schedule F to be able to fire federal employees more easily. Of course, this could be easily overturned by a subsequent administration, but it's clear that the Biden administration is trying to fall on the side of keeping these career employees in place. And The Spectator did some reporting on this. We talked to some former political appointees during the Trump administration who shared some of the ridiculous roadblocks that they encountered by these career officials, one of whom refused to turn on a color printer for a cabinet secretary because they said that the office had to be cleared for 10 days before they would come in because they were scared of COVID. I mean, this is like the type of idiocy that people who are trying to get things done in the federal government are encountering on a daily basis. And it's absolutely ridiculous. And then my true final thoughts, just really briefly, are on Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg defending the Biden economy by saying that 4 years ago, people were unable to buy toilet paper, because of course, 4 years ago, we were just entering into the pandemic. And I just wanted to flag this because it's obviously the defense that the Biden administration and the campaign are going to continue to deploy ahead of November as they try to defend the massive inflation and supply chain issues that have been really damaging Americans' ability to pay for basic necessities. They will try to pin the pandemic era economic woes on the former president. And I mean, to be fair, obviously Trump did go along with a lot of the horrible lockdown ideas presented to him by the public health bureaucracy, but to blame him for the economic ramifications of the entire COVID-19 pandemic was pretty ridiculous. And comparing that to what is supposed to be now a functional, healthy economy, and seeing the inflation and the other issues, high interest rates that Americans are dealing with, is so dishonest that it deserves nothing but contempt.
So I'll just tick off a few things really quick. First, on Schedule F and the Biden administration seeking to stymie a future Trump policy, there are also other regulatory means the administration is taking in the Office of Personnel Management, but also at EPA and elsewhere. And it seems like they're kind of trying to box just in case a future Trump administration. So you can already see what I would call maybe the makings of a pre-sabotage effort in place. And that's something definitely worth watching in the weeks and months ahead. One story, a positive story for once, a federal judge in D.C., Anna Reyes, last week smacked down the Justice Department for not complying with congressional subpoenas after the Justice Department railroaded Peter Navarro and put him behind bars for flouting such subpoenas. So this is surprising because the judge, Judge Reyes, is a Biden appointee. Now, she still isn't necessarily holding DOJ's feet to the fire beyond the rhetoric, but I guess we'll see how the case unfolds. But surprisingly good news for once out of a DC courtroom. Couple other points. There's been some interesting reportage and studying done recently of employment statistics, which suggests that all of the job growth basically in America is foreign-born individuals, while Americans have been dropping out of the workforce in droves. And basically the only thing keeping the employment rate at, you know, roughly steady or slightly up in terms of unemployment is the foreign-born, which may help explain why Americans are so down on the economy, yet the economic numbers don't show on their face to be as terrible as they might otherwise. And this is why I always recommend looking at labor force participation rate as well, because the rate, of course, is driven by also who is looking for jobs versus who has dropped out of the workforce. Last but not least, to talk sort of my own book, at Real Clear Politics, Carl Cannon had a great takedown, systematic evisceration of a New York Times hit piece on Real Clear. And I think it shows you, it's illustrative of what the New York Times does and obviously what the regime media does whenever they face an individual or an entity or an outlet that they don't like. So definitely well worth a read in terms of sort of how it's done in media criticism.
Yeah, my final thought is, Israel, I actually listened to a very interesting podcast, Dan Senor's podcast on Israel this week, and they've taken a huge number of their operational troops out of the Gaza Strip. They're basically only holding on to their corridor and that splits the north and south in half, but otherwise they've pulled their troops out. This in the aftermath of the killing of a bunch of aid workers and the World Food Kitchen and the Biden administration's anger about that. People need to flag this. Like, Israel has seemed pretty resolved in Gaza for a very long time, but the people on this podcast who are Israelis who would know think that things might be changing for the worse on that front, largely due to the enormous pressure that the Biden administration is putting on Netanyahu. So there's some concern that the United States is just preventing Netanyahu from winning the war. I hope we're not doing that. I'm really quite tired of watching an American administration not care about American hostages and siding with the people holding American hostages, because let's remember that a good number of the Israelis are also American citizens. And I just hope this all, I'm really quite tired of the Biden administration on this front.
And with that, I think that wraps it up for us this week. So on behalf of Amber, Will, and Ben, thanks for tuning in. I'm Inez Stettman, and we'll see you at the next NatCon Squad.